Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Hutchinson. I'm here with my co-hosts, John Gee and Kevin Christensen. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening.
And we are here for the second half of our Interpreter Foundation radio broadcast this evening. We want to begin by thanking our sponsor. That is Cruise Lady. So we have talked about this many times on the program before, but Cruise Lady specializes in tours that are of interest to Latter-day Saints. So if you're interested in a Book of Mormon cruise or some kind of church history cruise, or, for example, going to the Passion Play in Oberammergau, or especially the one we've got coming up next year to the Ultimate, I believe it's called the Ultimate
Egypt
Tour. With one of our tour guides is here in studio with us, John Gee. That one will be in November of 2021. So if you're interested in something like that, go ahead,
John. There are still a few places left.
So anyway, we're hoping that Egypt will be open to Americans by then. Apparently it currently is not. But, you know, you can join people like Martin Tanner, or you can join Jack Welch, Dan Peterson, or like we said, John Gee, and is it Hoppy?
No, it's the Ultimate Egypt Tour is me, Dan Peterson. Maybe we should put that in the other order. And Honey Tawfiq.
Honey Tawfiq, okay. And anyway, Cruise Lady, they specialize in making sure that their customers are safe. And like I talked about in the last hour and have mentioned before, the travel industry has really taken a beating. So we want to thank Cruise Lady for continuing their sponsorship of this program. And if you want more information about what they have to offer or about signing up for any of their tours, you want to call them at 801-453-9444. That is 801-453-9444. Or you can visit them at cruiselady.com. We also want to mention that we are brought to you by the Interpreter Foundation. It is an entirely volunteer organization, I think, except for a few paid assistants, which we are not, as you can tell from the quality of the broadcast. But anyway, one of the things that they do is a weekly article that you can sign up for on the Internet. We also have these broadcasts every week with a series of hosts and co-hosts. And then there are a lot of other things that they offer online in particular. And one of the most important that they do is a weekly Come Follow Me segment where they list a lot of resources. And then also on Interpreter Radio every week, there's a discussion about a certain Come Follow Me section. And this time we are going to be talking about
Ether 6 through 11.
And, you know, when you talk about the Book of Ether, it's fascinating to me because the title of the lesson, That Evil May Be Done Away. And doing away with evil is not what normally comes to my mind when I think about this section of the Book of Ether.
Yes, it almost seems like the at the end, the Jaredites flipped the 13th article of faith and said, if there's anything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy, we seek after and destroy these things.
Yeah, or we do not seek after them. So, you know, this is a really interesting section, though, because it's, as I think about it, I remember taking the Pearl of Great Price class from Hugh Nibley. And I remember, John laughs, and Kevin would laugh, and everybody I've ever talked to who's ever taken a class from Hugh Nibley it's not like it's a traumatic experience, but it's definitely an eye-opening experience. And I remember he said, I always start with the Book of Abraham, so we're not going to do that this time. We're going to talk about Joseph Smith Matthew. And we proceeded to spend 6 weeks on the Joseph Smith translation of the 25th chapter of Matthew, which was eye-opening. And I remember, though, one of the things that Nibley pointed out was that the Book of Mormon starts out with these, I guess he called them apocalyptic experiences, or, I mean, it just you have Lehi's dream. He's taken up into the heavens. You have all these miraculous events. Then you're there in the wilderness, and they get the Liahona, and it guides them to the promised land. So that's one way. We come to the Jaredites, and we have just the simple Book of Ether, which covers a period of time twice as long as the Book of Mormon, and it starts almost in the same way. It starts with a real bang spiritually, because you've got the brother of Jared, you've got the visions. He goes unto the mountain where he has the experience with the Lord, and there's a lot of temple ramifications with that. And then in our section right here, we have the shining stones in each end of each of the ships that they take to get to the promised land. And so I don't want to use the word magic, okay? But we have these incredibly dramatic miracles that start right out of the gate that lead the people, that guide the people to the promised land. And then we have a period of time where they have righteous, they have the pride cycle multiple times. And then, of course, you get the last three chapters, which we won't be dealing with, where it's, you know, a lot of more spiritual things come out, and then they're destroyed. So it's almost like it's a microcosm of the Nephite history, only in 15 chapters.
And in this, but it's a little bit different as well, because we get the bulk. So what we've got is basically the history portion.
Yeah.
Because we're missing the spectacular stuff.
But see, I love history,
12
though.
And,
yeah, but we so, no, but we have a little bit, because we have the shining stones, right?
I'm not trying to shaft it. I'm just pointing out that there's a difference. We don't have the spectacular visions of the brother of Jared.
Right.
We don't have Moroni's contemplations on Ether's predicament and the end of this. We're missing the beginning. We're missing the end. We just get the history down through here.
We get the middle part of a trilogy.
Yes.
So, and Kevin, what are you? What's your impression of this section before we dive into the details?
Well, just have memories of, you know, getting through it the first time, and it's very condensed because there's so much period of time, and then just a it's a sketch, you know, in that sense. But because you've got the context of the Book of Mormon history beforehand, leading into it, and ties, you know, with like the biblical accounts, where there's you know, the reference to the Great Tower, and there's also alternative allusions to the Noah story going on with the water crossing, and then it's so concentrated and extremely dramatic, and you get glimpses of light in there. Like I was noticing in Ether 9:22 about one of these kings is and he saw the peace in the land. Yet he even saw the Son of Righteousness and did rejoice in glory in his days, and he died in peace. You know, so there's spiritual things going on, but there's also a lot of politics and a lot of ups and downs and pride cycle. And
sounds like it's perfect for a day, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's perfect. It is, you know, and the kind of things that are going on with crime and government and divisions and periods of peace and what's necessary for that, and the kinds of, you know, basically lust for greed and power and revenge that drives them down. It is very, very relevant to us. And when I read Lehi in the Desert and the World of the Jaredites, you know, that was an eye-opener for me, because, you know, contextualizing the Book of Ether, and then he did another series called There Were Jaredites, which was comparing the Book of Ether to epic milieu. And that, you know, because I'd read a lot of mythology before I'd gotten into this stuff, then that sort of gave it some more depth for me, because I could connect it to a larger world. And that's kind of, I think, the best approach to the Book of Ether is the more you bring to it, the more you can get out, because it's so concentrated.
Yeah, for those who may not be aware, Kevin is talking about a series of articles by Hugh Nibley. There were three of them published in the what was called the Improvement Era, soon to be the Liahona as the grandchild of it, and then the Ensigns in the middle of it. But it was in the early 1950s he did a series called Lehi in the Desert. And then he did another series called
The World of the Jaredites.
And then in 1956 or 7, he did a series called There Were Jaredites. Originally, the first two were published together, but in 1988, Farms put together as Volume 5 of the Collected Works of Hugh Nibley, edited by Jack Welch, those three volumes together, those three series of articles together with the footnotes updated like the rest of the series. And so if you want to, as Kevin says, if you want an eye-opening introduction to the world of the Jaredites from a different perspective, a more historical, more cultural perspective, that is a really good place to start.
Yes, that's a nice summary of that. The only thing I would add to it is you get a very interesting review of the 1988 book by David Honey, who is my colleague over in Asian Near Eastern Languages, who is a historian of the area that Nibley
said was the,
marched
kind of like the Mongols.
Yeah, well, he's a historian of that area, and he has an insightful interview or
a review.
Some review of it.
Where was that published again?
That was published in what we used to affectionately know as Robot Bomb, the review of books by Book of Mormon.
Okay.
And
yeah. That's an in-joke that I'm not part of.
It's,
for
no,
those
it's,
of you
it's,
who
if
are
you
listening.
Took the review of books on the Book of Mormon, if you took the initials of that, it spells out Robot Bomb. And that wasn't intentional.
You can find it at Scholars Archive, by the way,
Scholars
at BYU.
Yeah, Scholars Archive, BYU.edu. Or you can find it. If you're having problem locating that, you can look at it in through the BYU Library website, lib.byu.edu, and you look in Scholars Archive, and that book and the review of it. Most but not all of the Old Farms material you can find there. It's a great resource. And one of the more popular portions of the BYU website. So those are, it's a very interesting thing, a little bit speculative on Nibley's part, but amazingly insightful overview.
I always have enjoyed watching or reading the reviews by other BYU professors of Nibley's work. I know, I think it was Kent Jackson who did a review of Old Testament and Related Studies when it first came out.
And you can actually see some of the
you'll
echoes
see people
of
who,
that
who,
in his latest article.
You actually see people who politely but firmly disagree with one another. And, that's healthy to have different viewpoints, provided that, and that's the way to do it, like we were talking about earlier. You want to do that. Just judge the work. Don't worry about all the froth and nonsense. And that's one of the things about podcasts that I really struggle with. They're designed to give information quickly and in a certain way and in an entertaining way and not always in a thoughtful and precise and accurate way.
Well, hopefully this podcast, for those of you who listen to it on a
except
podcast,
for us.
Will,
except for us. Well, they'll know it's not done in an entertaining way, that's for sure. But anyway, this is a fascinating period of history, though, as Kevin was saying, that there's just little glimpses of things. But there's some really important things here. So what I'd like to do is begin by asking both of you, why did Moroni put this here, and why did he emphasize what he did? I mean, we've got the middle of it, and maybe that's just the... It's the meat of the sandwich, but there's some really important things here that we can glean. And I think one of them has to do with the destruction of the Jaredites. And Moroni goes on to explain that this is the destruction of actually the Nephites as well. And it's obviously a warning to us today. But why did Moroni think to put this where he did and why he did? Kevin, what do you think?
Well, he's talking about this is a land, it's a covenant land, choice above all other lands, which kind of goes with the covenant, but he's seeing his people when Moroni is doing this, he's already watched the fall and destruction of his people. He's already seen it, and he's lived through it, and he's seen his father die, and his people die, and he saw how they died, and then they have this record of the Jaredites, which tells the same story, and this is another people who have been wiped off. And in Nibley's books, when he talks about it, he points out that in the old world, there are countries that have been there for thousands of years, but over here, you know, it's very new. When I grew up in Salt Lake, and there were buildings that were maybe 50, 60, 70 years old sometimes. And when I went to England, and there's a plane that's coming down, like in 1973, I felt something I didn't even know what to expect. But as soon as the plane touched down on the land, I felt history come up out of the ground. You know, it wasn't something I anticipated, but I just realized that there's something different. First night I went tracting, I went past the house that James Watt was born in, inventor of the steam engine. You know, and I saw churches that were 1,000 years old in some places, and more than that. And then I didn't even get to, you know, some of the Roman stuff that was older than that. The oldest thing that I've seen in the States was when my wife and I visited the Hopis, and some of those, you know, some of the oldest continuously occupied structures in North America are there. And, you know, they're about 800 or 900 years old. So it's just so much history in Europe that is absent for the most part in the Americas, and that's because we get wiped out. You know, we've got opportunities, but we're accountable, and we have to, if we don't shape up, we're going to get shipped out.
John?
That's a great question. I'm not sure that I completely have an answer to why Moroni put some of this stuff in. I do see some of the
this is being recorded, you know.
Well.
John Gee, headline, John Gee doesn't have the answer.
That could be true on all kinds of topics.
Exactly.
As long as we're talking about Nibley. Nibley said once in class that all you have to do is to get humility is start making a list of all the subjects you're not an expert in. And he said the beginning of education is got to be humility, realizing that you don't know the answers, and then you try to fill in the gaps.
That is not a class they taught us in law school, I can tell you that. That's one of my biggest flaws, is I pretend to know everything.
Well,
thankfully, I have this program
to
teach me otherwise.
A couple of things that I find interesting with Ether, and I'm not sure this is why. In some cases, I think, let me put in the one that I think Moroni probably put in intentionally to let us know about, and that's the rise of the secret combinations. Because he gets into it in more personal detail here than they really do in the Nephite record.
Well, Mormon dealt with it in the Nephite record.
Right, but even then, I don't think you got
Helaman.
It nearly to the personal detail that you get here. And then there's the thing that's in here that is really interesting, but I'm not really sure that was Moroni's intent. So if you look at the very, in Ether chapter 6, they start out and they want to offer the kingship to the brother Jared's son.
Okay, they're guided here. They're the 344 day journey on the boats.
No,
and,
well, I'm going to get. We can get back to that. But once they get here, they try to and Jared and his brother are getting old. And it's time to hand it down to the next generation. They do all of the brother of Jared's kids, and they say no. And then they go through all of Jared's kids, and one by one, and they say no, except the youngest one.
And then he says, yeah, I'll be the king.
He says, yes, I'll be the king. And then after that, it seems to be that the Jaredite kingship is passed not to the oldest, but to the youngest son.
That would explain a lot of things there.
And because you always get this, you know, they were really old, and they begat this one, and they take over the kingship. And it seems to be that first generation sets the example, and then they pass it down to the youngest. which is a very, very different system.
Well, in a way, but you look at what happens here. There's a lot of violence. There's constantly people usurping the kingship, even from their own parents.
Right, and from their own parents. And it's almost as though, the older son is like, yeah, you're going to be king, you're going to be king. Oh, you got a new brother, you're not going to be king anymore. It's going to be this other person. and you can see that there might be some psychological things that work against that system, but they seem to hold to that system to a great extent, and with a number of exceptions, but they seem to hold to that system. But that's not something out of Joseph Smith's day or any of his background.
No.
Where would you get that from?
Well, the only parallels would be David was a younger brother, and Joseph.
And Solomon was a younger brother.
And Solomon, yeah. And yet that caused problems for them too. But that wasn't
That doesn't seem to be a general trend in that world, nor does it seem to be in Joseph Smith's world. The other complication that this makes is estimating time. Because in primogenitor systems, where you give it to the oldest, the average length of time between, and this is an average, right? So it doesn't work.
Well, 25 to 30 years.
About 25 years is in most systems a primogenitor. And so you can calculate time by generations. Well, if you're going off the youngest,
I was 40 when our youngest was born. So,
well, and I was nearly 50. So there's a difference there.
Yeah.
And then for some people who only have one or two children, it might be only 20 or so. But there's no way to even guess on the estimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I've checked in ancient Egyptian chronology. And
I was going to ask you there's anything.
It does actually work that way for 25.
But they did firstborn primarily.
They did firstborn, and it averages about 25 years on an average reign, say, in the New Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And so it works on the average. But how would you do that on either?
Yeah.
So there can be much longer periods of time.
That's
something that I don't think Moroni deliberately included.
Well, I think those are important points. I agree with you. I think that's something that came, who knows where it comes from, but I don't think that was Moroni's intention. But I do agree with you that the Gadianton report is important. And here was something. I ran across an article by Lee Donaldson from the Book of Mormon Symposium series that BYU did way back in the early 90s. This is from the ninth one. And it's called The Plates of Ether and the Covenant of the Book of Mormon. He's got a chart in here called Six Tragic Cycles in the Book of Ether. And the vast majority of them, John and Kevin, are in this section. And he just has there are six of them, and he goes, the people are delivered miraculously, then they prosper, then they have pride and iniquity, and then they're brought down. Okay? So the first one, they're delivered between chapter 1 and 33 from the time of the tower until they arrive in the promised land miraculously, chapter 6, verse 12. And after that, by chapter 7, verses 20 through 25, they've already gotten rich because the land is wealthy and it's the promised land and there's a covenant there. And then they get prideful and then they're brought down. Cycle 2 starts, they're delivered at chapter 7, verse 26. And by chapter 9, verse 12, they're back again. They're cast down. Then chapter 9, they're brought delivered. In the end of chapter 9, verse 54, they're brought down, and so forth. There are six of them, and all six are contained in these five or six chapters. And so, for me, once again, it's a microcosm, and Moroni, obviously, he doesn't have access to the same resources his father did. I mean, he has the plates, he has this, but there's also something that we haven't talked about, Kevin, and that is the sealed portion of these plates. if I understand it right, the vast majority of the sealed portion of the Book of Mormon came from the record they got from the people of Jared, did it not? And maybe
yeah, they get 24 plates
mm-hmm.
that are found by Limhi's.
Yeah.
The time
of Mosiah. Mosiah is the seer. He has the power to translate.
Mosiah translates them, and then they bring them back. They're translated by Mosiah, and they're kept. They're told some things about them, but only the prophets have access to them. And they said, "You're going to keep it this way until after the coming of Christ," and then. That's when, and Mormon plainly intended to include them, and Moroni fulfills his father's promise, abridges the record, so we just get the bare bones version, and then it comes out, and so we get the summary version here, and so we're not sure exactly how complete, where he's abridging and where he isn't, and just how complete it is, but it's a very bare bones lineage history. And because it's Ether putting together the plates originally, it's Ether's lineage, and when the government passes out of his lineage, he doesn't really talk about it. So in some ways, this is his ancestral history, but some of his ancestors are better than others. And so one of the ones that we ought to mention here is Morianton, who's seems to be an ancestor of Ether. And he said that he did justice to the people, but not to himself. And that's a really intriguing description of a ruler, and exactly what does it mean is something that there are various ways to take it and various things that you might understand by that. So we'll toss this back over to Kevin and see what do you make of somebody who is, this is apparently exceptional, who does justice to the people but not to himself.
Well, I think that's when Nibley talked about that, he talked about this as a point of that it's not just good and bad people. You know, you're on one side or the other in a sense as a person, but there's good and bad and all people, and this happened to be his weakness. And it's interesting that he's not all good or all bad, but there are things that he does for other people that he can't do himself. And I know people like that. You know, it's there. It's part of humanity. And I think he had a son who did better, and then the pride cycle starts again. But it's that sense that there's something that everybody has to work on and just think, well, I have these virtues, therefore I can count myself as one of the good people, or I'm on the right side, or I'm in the right party. I don't have to repent because I'm on the right side of the boundary that... that I'm going to be measured by, instead of continual repentance, constantly looking at ourselves and saying, "You know, what more can I do?"
That's just an interesting comment. I mean, it's kind of like the one you were referring to earlier, Kevin, where one of them saw the Son of Righteousness, and so throughout these generations, I mean, once again, we're talking what, a couple thousand years almost, and you know, you just get these little statements here and there of a massive lineage, and it's interesting that this is one that Moroni, or Ether, as it were, chose to pull out. I get a sense that there's a little kinship between Ether and Moroni, because I mean, who Ether reports on the destruction of the people, just as Moroni does. He's the last guy there, but surprisingly, it wasn't Ether that brings the plates to Mosiah, to Limhi's people. They found somebody else who had the plates, and then that guy died.
They just found the plates.
They just found the plates, yeah.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, the kingship, I think, is there's one of my all-time favorite papers on the Book of Mormon. It's one by Lisa Bowen Hawkins and Gordon Thomason called Survivor Witness in the Book of Mormon.
Where was it at, Kevin?
It's a Farm's Preliminary Report. There's a brief summary of it, and
Respond
the Book of Mormon.
Way back.
Yeah, this is way back.
You're dating yourself here.
Yeah, well, it's there's a Jewish scholar studied certain people that went through the Holocaust, and also in the Nazi death camps and the Soviet death camps, and found out that certain people through that experience felt compelled to survive so that they could bear witness what happened, and they wanted to give a report so that they could speak for the dead, so that the suffering wouldn't be lost forever, and also to be what they called an objective witness of evil. You know, not to condemn, to just to describe, simply to tell is one of the lines in there. And they go through and they show that certain people felt compelled just to survive so they could speak to the others. And then they would keep a record and write things down and bury it sometimes in a secret archive. And you go through and there's a distinct personality. And when you read that paper, you realize, yeah, this is Mormon and Moroni. You know, they fit to a T. It's breathtaking, I think. And so after having read that paper, I felt a tremendous amount of empathy and compassion and awareness more of Mormon and Moroni as distinct individuals who have been through this terrifying, dreadful, painful experience of just watching all of this death and horror, and then needing to maintain their own integrity in the face of all of that. And part of doing that, part of maintaining their own integrity, is to stand apart as a witness and to describe, to tell.
Well,
and I would think
there's
that
some of the Holocaust survivors that did that.
That was the point. And that's the description in the paper. And then Bowen and Thomason, Bowen Hawkins and Thomason realized, yeah, this casts great light on the character of the narrators of the Book of Mormon. So it's a very, you know, for me, it put the blood pumping through the pages. You know, this is flesh and blood, and this is a real person who has something very important to tell me, and I can see it, you know, and I can feel it. You know, it's between the lines, and it puts breath in these words. And so as for a kinship between Ether, another witness, another survivor witness who created a record and wrote the downfall of his people, and then when Moroni is getting this record and he's in the same boat, yes, he would feel a tremendous kinship.
And I think that kinship is underlined in the last verse in Ether. Moroni puts in, and you see this kinship here. Now the last words which are written by Ether are these, and they would apply to Moroni as well. Whether the Lord will that I be translated or that I suffer the will of the Lord in the flesh, it mattereth not, if it so be that I am saved in the kingdom of God. Amen. And clearly Moroni thought he was ending his record there, because the next verse, the beginning of his own book, said, I had supposed not to have written.
Yeah.
So he thought, I just ended the book. So Moroni actually ends several times before he finally ends. But this shows that kinship there, where he thinks that Ether's last words can serve as his own last words as well.
Right. And getting back to the point that we made earlier, in the Come Follow Me individual guide, there is a list of the kings that they provide. And it just basically says, below are just a few of the kings mentioned in these chapters. Read the verses, see what you can learn from their examples, positive and negative, about leadership. And as you do, think about opportunities you might have to lead or influence others in your home, your community, your church calling, and so on, which actually was a theme of this general conference. And they go through with Uriah, Shul, Jared, Emer and Coriantum, Heth, Shez, Riplakish. Well, there's that secret combination thing, if I remember. And then Morianton, and Lib and Etham.
Well, I think Shula is an interesting case in point, because Shula is a righteous king and has the kingship taken away from him. And it's restored later. But here the king is righteous and by all accounts would seem to have been destined for the dust heap because he's captured. His other sons rescue him at the last minute, and he has to hide out. He spends most of his kingship in hiding. So he's not, even though he's righteous, he's not necessarily prospering in the way that we might think he ought to prosper.
Well, and you know, this thing about the kingship for this section, in Grant Hardy's Book of Mormon Study Edition, there is a chart specifically near the back about the kings of the Jaredites. And it traces who's a usurper, who's legitimate line, kind of what happens to them. I mean, there's no dates or anything else, but just a list of all these names to help you keep track of what you're talking about. But one of the things, like you said about Shula, is he remembered the great things the Lord had done. I think that's one of the themes that we see in some of these righteous kings here, is it mentions he remembered the great things the Lord had done, and therefore he was righteous, and he exercised good judgment all his days. And, you know, that's on the title page of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, and
to remember the great things the Lord hath done.
And also one of the last things that Moroni says, we tend to skip over it when we get to Moroni's promise, but he says, you know, you need to remember all the things that the Lord done, and remember how merciful he's been to the children of men from the creation of Adam until you read this.
Yes.
And,
By the way, we won the lottery for the Interpreter Foundation Radio because we get to talk about Moroni 10 next month.
Next month. Well, yes. But we get to talk about Ether.
That's
month.
Right. That's right.
So, Ether is, the Book of Ether has a lot of, although it's formulaic in the way it presents this, it's a lineage history, it's a history of the kings, some of the little asides about the kings and how they rule are worth looking at and pondering at what. And you might think if somebody's going to take your life and reduce it to a verse or two, what will they say about you?
Well, we see that in Omni, in the Book of Mormon, in the small plates. It's the same thing.
Well, except for there, they're talking about themselves. This is somebody else talking.
Yeah,
about.
Yeah. And the, you know, the, obviously there's a lot of them that can't have been mentioned because, I mean, you know, the names that they list, that wouldn't last that long, would it? I mean,
Well, we got
Tower
40
Babel.
Generations, and that's where the problem with the ultimate genitor comes in, is that how old are the previous king when the youngest son is born? And so it's harder to determine just how much time.
Yeah,
it's harder to estimate.
I mean, the dates that they give you, one of them, the wife dies at like 102 or something.
Well, we can get into all this difference between our Western calendar and Mesoamerican calendar and all that, but it's still a long time.
Yeah, it's a long way.
Well, we don't know.
You know, one of the other things, and Frank Judd, and we talked last month about the new book from the Book of Mormon Academy called Illuminating the Jaredite Records. And Frank Judd has an article in there called Moroni's Six Commentaries in the Book of Ether. So there are six times when Moroni interjects in the Book of Ether and gives these presentations, and Dr. Judd talks about them. Only one occurs in this block we're talking about today. It's the fifth one. It's his commentary from chapter 8, verses 20 through 26. However, this is something that we talked about, touched on earlier tonight, and we really probably ought to focus on for a while here. It's a brief discussion of secret combinations and an assessment of the story that comes up. And, you know, there's some differences between, as you were pointing out, John, the way the secret combinations are addressed here as opposed to the way they're presented in Helaman and in other places in the Book of Mormon. But obviously, Moroni feels pretty strongly about them. and they're important enough for us probably to pay attention to today.
Yeah, I think one of the main things that we want to pay attention to with the secret combination is the desire for power that seems to go behind all of them, and particularly in the Jaredi record, where he's disappointed because he doesn't get to be king. And he had tried to take over, and so his daughter.
And we're talking about Achish, are we not?
Well, it's Jared's. Jared's daughter comes to him
That's
with
right.
a plan.
That's right.
And says, "Well, let's. I'll get Achish."
Achish is the outsider, and
he's in favor with the king, and he can kill him for you. Only Achish decides to do the whole.
Well, he lets Jared take over, and then he usurps him.
Right.
He says, "Nah, this isn't good enough. I want to be the king."
Yeah, and Jared's daughter ends up being the queen, but the whole, she goes in there saying, "Well, let me seduce Achish," and so you're getting a couple of different things of a violation. Well, at least using lust to drive this in order to get power and gain. And so there, but that drive, that ambition, that wanting to be in charge, and that's a key element for, most people. It's just something that you need to be aware of. And I remember coming out of a party many years ago, and my wife pointed out that I'd never realized so-and-so and so-and-so were so ambitious. And then to see some of what happened a few years down the road was interesting and revealing about the character, but it started with that ambition.
So what do you think are some of the differences, Kevin, or similarities?
With the secret combinations?
Yes.
Just what he's saying right here, and he's looking at this, and he's, "The Lord works not in secret combinations, and neither doth he will that man should shed blood, but in all things hath forbidden it from the beginning." He doesn't have to write the oath, but he says, interestingly, "They are had among all people, and they are had among the Lamanites." He doesn't have to write it down. It's like it's a secret that's no real secret, because this stuff goes on all over the place. "Whatsoever nation shall uphold secret combinations to get power and gain, and they shall spread over the nation, behold, they shall be destroyed. For the Lord will not suffer that the blood of his saints, which shall be shed by them, shall always cry unto him from the ground for vengeance upon them, yet he avenged them not. Wherefore, O ye Gentiles," and that's addressing us,
"yeah,
"it is wisdom of God that these things should be shown unto you, that ye may repent of your sins, and suffer not that these murderous combinations shall get above you, which are built up to get power and gain, and the work, even the work of destruction, shall come upon you. Yea, even the sword of justice of the eternal God shall fall upon you, yea, to your overthrow and destruction, if ye shall suffer these things to be." So he wants us to be awake to this thing. I mean, this is telling these stories to wake us, to wake us up, to get us so that we can see what's happening, so that when we do see it, that we can do something about it. And, the story in the book of, and was it the Lamanites? Let's preach the gospel to them.
Well,
change their hearts.
I think in verse 25, he talks about how these are really Satan,
yeah,
the foundation of them, because Satan, it says, "Whoso buildeth it up seeketh to overthrow the freedom of all lands, nations, and countries, and it bringeth to pass the destruction of all people. For it is built up by the devil, who is the father of all lies." And a lot of these things start with lies. Lies,
yeah,
to get power, as it were. Would you say,
yeah,
that's the case?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Lies to get power. And, and that has a certain resonance.
I mean, he goes on to say that was the same liar who beguiled our first parents. So right in the Garden of Eden. Kind of,
yeah,
reminded me, I was able to attend a live session in the Manti Temple a few weeks ago with somebody that we're close to who was taking out her endowment. And I have never been to a live endowment before, which was a very interesting experience. The Manti Temple is spectacular inside. I had been there for some ceilings over the years, but had never done a session there. And then, of course, with the COVID situation, that was something I just recommend to people that if they get the opportunity when the temples open up a little more, go down to Manti and do that. It's a it was a reminder to me how real the endowment is. And of course, the corollary is something like, you know, Kevin was saying earlier, it adds flesh and blood to this, because the liar in the garden was Satan. And when you see it live as opposed to the film, or, you know, whatever they're using now, PowerPoint or something, it's much different when it's a regular person, but it's still, like we said, focused on lies. And then, of course, he lied to Cain. He was the liar who caused man to commit murder from the beginning. So I just, you know, I'm commanded to write these things that evil may be done away. Time may come when Satan may have no power. But once again, both Mormon and Moroni were very specific to keep certain parts of those secret combination or reports of those out of the records that they handed down.
And yet
they came about anyway.
And Mormon is, and we've already gone over Mormon in the Come Follow Me, but Mormon is interesting because when he gets to his own day, he gets very reticent about what he says. He loves the people, but he sees all the iniquities and abominations that are going on around them. He sees a whole lot more than he says. And if you want to get an inkling of how bad it was, you look at his letters to his son rather than the record he left behind for us, because he just...
Yeah, he's much more frank about what was going on.
And he provides details as just how bad it was. And he talks about how bad it was in his... He just says, this is really bad, and I'm not going to harrow up your mind, but there are some really awful things that people were doing to each other, all in the name of power and gain. He knew what the start of that was, and he got to see where it ended. And Moroni has seen the same thing and passes that on, because the same thing happens to Ether, and it's... This sort of thing happens to throughout human history. There's an amazing record left by one of the Hittite rulers about the same sorts of things going on among that people. And so you have to wonder about people who are so willing to get power that they'll do anything to get it.
And then, of course, what they do with it when they get it is usually bad.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have the example we talked about earlier, the guy who personally didn't do himself any favors, but at least he was good to the people.
Right.
Rarely. Rarely. In fact, I don't think we see any of them. In fact, Moroni talks about that specifically, that the secret combination's goal is to take away the freedom of all people and all nations.
And you can see some of that in, say, Lycaonius's, the correspondence with Lycaonius between Gadion Roberts and Synther Nephi, and it's just, and the willingness, as you pointed out, to lie about it. He says, you know, this is of ancient date. Not really. There are people around who might have been around at the beginning of that, at that point. And they're willing to twist things to make it sound like they've got reasonable claim.
Well, Kevin, one of the things that struck me about the secret combinations, particularly that was described in Helaman, was the Lamanites and the Nephites, but the Lamanites were able to band together and get rid of them. They got rid of them somehow. And yet we don't really see any record. Yeah, for a short period. But we don't really see any of that here in Ether. I mean, the people have their pride cycle, but it doesn't say they got rid of them. Once they showed up on the scene, maybe they were there to stay and they just had, I don't know, maybe they were outside the regular stream of government. I don't know.
Well, there's different forms of it. Sometimes the military, sometimes they're within government, sometimes it's crime. You know, in the Book of Mormon, they take various forms, but the idea is the power and gain. But the thought that's coming to me is how the Lamanites preached to them. You know, they didn't send armies out to them. They sent preachers out to them, and they changed their hearts to turn them away from the power and the gain and the lies. And there's a passage in the Doctrine of Covenants where it says, pure knowledge greatly enlarges the soul without hypocrisy and without guile. The implication is that impure knowledge contracts the soul and encourages both hypocrisy and guile. And so this idea about Satan being a liar and lying lead to this thing, because it's a distortion of reality. It's trying to manipulate reality into serving us rather than acknowledging, you know, us. You know, first thing, we don't know anything, and we're all in this together. I mean, that should be basic to reality, and that it would be better if we bear one another's burdens than may be light, and that every man should seek the interest of his neighbor instead of, am I my brother's keeper? I'm in it for myself and all I can get, and I'll do whatever it takes to get that. And it's the enlargement of the soul is seeing yourself in the other person instead of an obstacle or an impediment or a rival. If we see each other as brothers and sisters all in this together, then we'll treat each other differently than if we see other people as something to get rid of or to get something from.
I think we could end there, but we still have a little bit of time. That was phenomenal, Kevin.
Yeah. So we'll sort of trail off with our own little thoughts here for the last 5 minutes. We put this in the podcast. They can just chop it off here.
Well, yeah, let's, I think Kevin just dropped the mic on us over there. I would just say this, though, Kevin. I think something that you said, when we're bearing one another's burdens, the way to combat the father of all lies is to speak the truth. So
when
we do that, but when you speak the truth to someone, are they going to listen? And I think if they sense that we care about them because we're in the trenches with them and we're bearing their burdens with them like the covenant says, I think that's how we get them to listen to the truth. Have you ever had an argument with somebody on social media about something?
Yeah. I don't think about King Lear right at this point. Because at the start of the tragedy of King Lear takes place when he's got the three daughters, and two flatter him for power, and the third, Cordelia, tells him the truth. And that kind of leads to a lot of tragedy in the course of the story, but the important thing is that eventually that truth got through to Lear, and he is transformed, and, you know, the whole structure of the play, he loses everything, but it's the whole point of the Shakespeare's King Lear is to turn the story, what profiteth a man if he gain the whole world but lose his soul? In Lear, Shakespeare is saying, okay, let's flip that. Let's show a man who starts with everything and loses it all but gains his soul. And that's what John pointed about. It matter if not, if I am so saved in the kingdom of God, and no matter what other people do, or how they treat us, or how they react when we tell them the truth, sometimes it's truth they don't want to hear, as Cordelia tells Lear, but that can be saving, and that's the way that we can save each other. Sometimes we have to, you know, say the truth that they don't necessarily want to hear, but because it's the truth, it should be said.
I think I'd agree with you on that, because there's a certain extent where sometimes you really want to persuade someone of the truth, but there are other times when you just need to say the truth whether or not they're persuaded. And that's, and it won't persuade them, but you have spoken the truth. And it's like Jacob says, and he says, I need to rid my garments of your blood. So I'm going to tell you what you need to hear, whether or not you accept it. And sometimes we need to bear our witness knowing that it's going to be rejected and hoping that you might have an Alma in the audience that it changes. Well, but you don't know whether you've got an enema in the audience.
But you also get lit on fire when that happens, too.
Well, that does happen, but sometimes that's what you need to do. Sometimes it's your lot to be Enoch and turn the whole civil or your whole city to righteousness, and sometimes it's your lot to be Abinadi, and you don't know that you converted anybody when you go.
Yeah, and then you go. So, yeah, that's a good point. I had an experience where I was told that, you know, something like that would happen, that when something was done and a process was done, the people would not have any excuse. They would have no argument. So, you know, and I think we do that by the power of discernment, determining where and when to play that card of speak the truth no matter what versus build the relationship to speak the truth and hope it works, and sometimes you bite your lip. But those are fascinating comments. We want to thank you for your comments, Kevin. John, it's been a pleasure as always. We will be here next month, but in the meantime, join us every week for Interpreter Foundation Radio. This is Terry Hutchinson and Kevin Christensen and John Gee signing off.